starts out this way: the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. The preacher. The word, the preacher there is Ecclesiastes in the Greek, which is where we get the book of Ecclesiastes, surprisingly enough. It doesn't mean the preacher necessarily as you're thinking, preacher at the front of the church, preacher, but it means one who calls to assembly. It says it's written by the son of David, king in Jerusalem. In verse 12, he's going to say, king over Israel in Jerusalem, which narrows it down because son of David could be any of David's descendants. It could mean kin of David. But there was only one son of David who was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and that would have been Solomon. There are some, everybody universally accepted that this was written by Solomon until sometime in the 18th century when we started getting smarter than we had a right to be. And then a bunch of people, for linguistics reasons, because of some of the language used, made the decision that this couldn't possibly have been written by Solomon, and it was just someone who stole Solomon's name to add credence to what they wrote. But it seems pretty clear to me who it's written by. I don't have a problem with it. Ecclesiastes is one of those books that you need to handle carefully. There's going to be some phrases that are repeated. It's not a long book. It's 12 chapters, I think. 28 times he's going to say vanity or vanity of vanities, meaning, and vanity means emptiness. He's going to say 9 times vexation of spirit, which in some translations is translated as chasing the wind, just utter frustration and uselessness. And the key phrase that really brings Ecclesiastes home is the phrase under the sun. 27 times he's going to use the phrase under the sun. And the thing to remember is Ecclesiastes is written by a man who is living as if everything that takes place, all there is what happens under the sun. Because of that, you're going to find there are some things that he says that are 100% doctrinally true. You look at verse 4, chapter 12, verse 14, he says, "For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil." No doubt that's true, that God's going to look at everything and that whether it's good or evil, he's going to take account. God doesn't miss anything. You can say, yeah, that's true. He's going to say some stuff that's part true and part not true. Ecclesiastes 1:4, he says, "One generation passes away and another generation comes." Well, that's true. We know that, you know, generation after generation. But then he says, "But the earth abides forever." We know that's not the case from reading the rest of Scripture, that it's scheduled to be destroyed. It's going to, as Peter tells us, you know, melt with a fervent heat. And then some stuff he says is only true if you are living like there is no afterlife, like this is all there is. In chapter 3, verse 19, he's going to say, "For that which befalls the sons of men befalls beasts. Even one thing befalls them. As the one dies, so dies the other. Yea, they all have one breath, so that a man has no preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity." What, there's no difference between men and animals? That's not true. He's going to say in chapter 9, verse 5, and this is a verse, one thing you'll find a lot of the weird aberrant theology, they love Ecclesiastes because they can take some of this stuff, kind of twist it out of its context and help support their cause. One of those is the idea of soul sleep. Another one is the idea of annihilation, that you die and that's it, that there's no hell, there's no heaven, there's no afterlife. And they'll look at a verse like Ecclesiastes 9:5, and he says, "For the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything, neither have they any more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten." They don't know anything. Well, but Jesus is the one who said, speaking of Moses talking to the burning bush, God saying, you know, "I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I'm not the God of the dead, but of the living." So there's stuff in Ecclesiastes, because it's said, it's 100% true in that this is what he said and what he wrote, and that it's 100% true that a person living as if they are under the sun, that there is nothing after this world, these opinions are what they'd hold. In fact, we're going to see a lot of what the atheist and agnostic, and what else, believe espoused in Ecclesiastes. But you got to be real careful in trying to build doctrine out of Ecclesiastes. One of the keys to life I have found in the few 40, just over 40 years I've been in it, there's a very good way to learn, and that is by proxy, if you possibly can. Take your lessons from other people's scar tissue. If you can, rather than go through it yourself, because there are some times, and those of you who have children understand this, sometimes you can tell them 100 times, don't touch that, it's hot. Don't stick your tongue on the frozen flagpole. And 9 times out of 10, there's 9 kids that won't do it, but there's that one kid, it doesn't matter how many times you tell them, they're going to try it, and they've got to learn through pain. If you can be someone who learns from someone else's experiences, you'll spare yourself an awful lot of trouble. And this is one of those books it would be wise to take note of, because you've probably heard the phrase. I mean, have you ever heard anybody say, I'd like the opportunity to prove that money can't make me happy? Right? You know, well, because we all have that thought that if we just had enough, we just had enough money, I know they say money doesn't bring happiness, but man, I'd like to prove that for myself. Give me a lot of money and then I'll try it out. Well, this guy is going to explore the outer limits of everything that you and I will never have the opportunity to do. This is what he says. We'll get going. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he takes under the sun? Now remember who Solomon was. In 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 5, it tells us that Solomon, when he was young, was in Gibeon, and the Lord appeared to him. And God said, ask what I shall give thee. God shows up to him, appears, and says, Solomon, just ask me for something, I'll give it to you. What do you want? Solomon said, thou hast showed unto thy servant David my father great mercy, according as he walked before thee in truth and in righteousness and in uprightness of heart with thee. Thou hast kept for him his great kindness. Thou hast given him a son to sit on a throne as it is this day. And he says, and now, O Lord my God, you have made thy servant king instead of David my father. And I'm but a little child. I know not how to come in or how to go out or to come in. And thy servant is in the midst of thy people, which thou hast chosen, a great people that cannot be numbered nor counted for multitude. Give therefore thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, that I may discern between good and bad. For who's able to judge this, thy so great a people? And the speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. And God said unto him, because you have asked for this thing, and you have not asked for thyself a long life, neither hast thou asked riches for thyself, nor thou hast asked for the life of thine enemies, but you've asked for yourself understanding to discern judgment. Behold, I have done according to thy words. Lo, I have given thee a wise and an understanding heart, so that there was none like thee before thee, neither after thee shall any arise like unto thee. I have given thee, which thou hast not asked, riches and honor, so there shall not be any among the kings like unto thee all thy days. He said, okay, Solomon. Solomon asked for wisdom and an understanding heart, and God said, I like that answer. I like that answer, so I'm going to give you what you asked for more than anyone has ever had, and also I'm going to give you the things you didn't ask for, wealth and authority and victory over your enemies, all of those things. I'm going to give it all to you, Solomon. And then it tells us in 1 Kings chapter 4, and this is pertinent to where we're going, verse 29, God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceeding much in largeness of heart, even as the sand that's on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of the children of the east country and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezrathite and Heman and Chalcol and Darda and the sons of, I guess these are all wise people, I don't know them, the sons of Mahal. He obviously was wiser because we remember Solomon and we don't remember these dudes. His fame was in all nations round about, and it tells us about what he did. He spake 3,000 proverbs, some of which we just finished in the book of Proverbs. In his songs were 1,005. Talk about a prolific songwriter. 1,005 songs. He spake of trees, from the cedar tree that's in Lebanon, even unto the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spake also of beasts and of fowl and of creeping things and of fishes. He was into wildlife. He understood animals. He understood birds and fish and insects. It says, and there came of all the people to hear the wisdom of Solomon from all the kings of the earth. That was Solomon. And he was loaded. It tells us in 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 21, all of the King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold. All the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. None were of silver. It was nothing accounted of in the days of Solomon. For the king had at sea a navy of Tarshish and the navy of Hiram. Once in 3 years came the navy of Tarshish to bring gold and silver and ivory and apes and peacocks. So King Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and wisdom. He was loaded. He had so much gold that in Solomon's day, silver was not, people didn't care about silver because there was so much gold, silver was worthless. That's how rich this guy was. So understand, this is a guy who is smarter than anybody you've ever met. He's richer than anybody you will ever meet or is on the earth today. And he is king. There's no check. There's no, I have to listen to this, I have to obey this law. He's the king. He can do whatever he wants. All the money, all the smarts, all the power and authority. If anybody can be happy in this life, this is the guy, right? He's the guy who says, what profit has a man, in verse 3, of all his labor which he takes under the sun? It's a treadmill. We work so we can make money, so we can buy food, so we can eat and stay strong and healthy, so that we can work, so that we can make money, so that we can buy food. So that we can... It just goes around and around. He says, one generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. It's funny, Peter talks about those people in 1 Peter chapter 3, 2 Peter chapter 3, excuse me, saying that in the last day there'll be scoffers who come and they'll say, you know, where's the promise of his coming? All things continue as they have from the beginning, that a person gets into a place of scoffing when they say, this is just all there ever is and it's going to continue the same. And that's where Solomon was. He was a person who was scoffing at life, we're going to see. He says, the sun also arises. The sun goes down and hastens to his place where he arose. Now, if you're sitting there thinking, oh, wait a minute, I thought this was the smartest guy who ever lived, and he thinks the sun goes around the earth. He's talking about the sun arising and going down. Obviously, the Bible's wrong, and he doesn't know anything. Yes, the earth revolves around the sun, and its spinning is what causes the sun to go up and sun to come down. We know that's true. Turn on the Weather Channel tomorrow, and they're going to have two dates on the two things on the screen tomorrow. They're going to have sunrise, they're going to have sunset, because we still call it that, even though we know that the world spins around. No, in fact, Solomon, look what he says next. He says, the wind goes towards the south and turneth about up unto the north. It whirls about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. He's going to say, all the rivers run into the sea. Yeah, the sea's not full. Under the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. He's talking about the weather patterns. He's talking about the hydrological cycle. Both of those things were not discovered, supposedly, until way after Solomon. An interesting guy to look at in history is a guy by the name of Matthew Maury. Around 1825, he was 20 years old or so, he joined the U.S. Navy. And among other things, he was a Christian. And he read the scriptures, and he read some verses. He read this one right here about the wind returning again according to his circuits. He read Psalm chapter 8. Psalm chapter 8, you guys are probably familiar with it, verse 3. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon, the stars, which thou hast ordained, what's man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, hast crowned him with glory and honor. Thou made him to have dominion over all the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, yea, the beasts of the field, the fowls of the air, the fish of the sea, and this was the key part, and whatsoever passes through the paths of the sea. And this guy, Matthew Maury, said, you know what? The Bible talks about paths in the sea, and it talks about circuits of the wind. I bet there really are paths in the sea, and I bet there really are circuits in the wind. I better start studying and see what I can find. And so he started studying. He was in the Navy. He started checking ship's logs. He started checking, taking record of weather circuits and all of that. And he is the guy who came up with what we observe in nature, many of the things that deal with the paths in the sea, like the Gulf Current that's 40 miles wide and 2,000 feet deep and goes from the Gulf of Mexico all the way up to the Atlantic and affects the weather all the way along the East Coast. He's the guy who first understood a lot of the weather patterns and the circuits of the winds, because he read the scripture and he said, this guy is the smartest guy who ever lived, and he seemed to understand this stuff. I bet I can understand it if I apply myself. And There's a lot of people who say, well, you know, the Bible, it's a bunch of made-up gibberish, and it causes you to be stupid. If you take the Bible literally, it would lead you to be a person who never needs to discover anything. Because you just take the Bible's word for everything. Rather than go out and search things out, you just take the Bible's word. No. You'll notice some of the greatest scientists in our history, Copernicus, Galileo, people like that, are people who took the scriptures and believed because this is created by a loving and orderly God, things must be designed and laid out in an orderly, logical fashion. I bet if I apply myself and I seek his face, he'll reveal this stuff to me. And some of the greatest scientists we've ever seen have been people who have taken the scripture at face value and then tried to search out what they say. But in Solomon's mind here, all of these things, the fact that the world just spins round and round, sunrise, sunset, that the rivers, you know, the water cycle goes up, comes down, the rivers run down, but they never run out, keeps going around and around. Just nothing ever changes. Nothing ever changes. He says, all things are full of labor, and man cannot utter it. The eye's not satisfied with seeing, the ear, nor the ear filled with hearing. Is there a truer statement in the world? The eye is not satisfied with seeing. It doesn't matter what you see, you always want to see more. It's funny how it works. Any of you guys ever have video games? I mean, my first video game when I was a kid was Pong. The two paddles wired to the controller. Boop, 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 boop. Play that thing for hours and hours, because it was the only thing you could play. There's no game cartridge. It was a console that did that. But then I had a friend who got an Atari 2600, and he had Space Invaders and Donkey Kong running over, jumping over the barrels, pounding with the hammer. Only, I mean, you had to be told they were barrels and a hammer, because they were blocks, all right? They were just blobs on the screen. But we'd sit in front of that thing for hours, and we'd play it until we wore the controllers out. But you get tired of those things after a while, and you want another game, and you want another game. And nowadays, you know, my kids have a Wii. My father-in-law bought us a Wii for Christmas a couple years ago, and we have different Wii games, and the kids want a new game, and they'll save up and buy a game, and then they'll start playing the game. And then they get tired of the game, and they want a new game. I mean, if your eyes could be satisfied with one thing, you'd have one game, and you'd never need another game. I can just play this all day. Oh, I've watched a movie. I can just watch that over. No. Probably the epitome of that is porn, what it does to a guy who looks at porn. Because when he gets in the habit of looking at naked people on a screen, it's not just one naked person. It's two, and then it's three, and it's five, and it's ten, and it's picture, it's picture, it's picture, it's picture. Because your eye's never satisfied. And there are people who think, well, I just need, you know, I've got these desires, so I just need to gratify them, and then I'll, you know. It's like trying to put out a fire with gas. It doesn't satisfy. It just wants more and more and more. Same with the ear. The ear's not filled with hearing. You know, when a new song comes out and it's like the best song ever, and you're like, I just want to play that all the time. I remember when I was a kid, I had my cassette player with the headphones, my Walkman, you know, and I had the 38 Special Forces tape. And I played that. I played the magnetism right off of that tape, listening to it over and over. Hold On Loosely. Best song ever. I could listen to it all the time. Can't stand that song anymore. I don't want to hear that ever again, because I get sick of it after a while. I want a new song. If you were satisfied with one song in the hearing, we'd have a one-song worship set. We'd play it six times, every service, three times. But we don't. We've got to mix in new stuff and continually bring in new stuff. Because if you don't, as people, we get like, oh, yeah, holy, holy, Lord Almighty, was and is to come. You know, you'd just be like so bored of a song. Solomon looked at the futility of life, and he said, you know, the eye's not satisfied with seeing, the ear's not filled with hearing. The thing that has been, it's the thing which shall be. The thing which is done is the thing which shall be. And there's no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It's already been of old time, that which was before us. Nothing ever changes. Things keep going around and around. Look at my pants. These are like almost, they're not bell bottoms, but they're flared. I hated these things. I remember, you know, being in the early 80s when I had my cool Levi 501 buttonfly jeans that were, you know, straight down to the, and thinking, I can't believe those stupid people wore flare pants back in the 60s and the 70s, those bell bottoms, what a bunch of fruits. Yeah. Worth big money now. You have to go to like a specialty shop to buy the vintage clothing. And you wait, everything just comes around. That's why, you know, my closet's full of stuff, because I keep thinking it's coming back. It's coming back. That mesh muscle shirt, it's coming back, baby. I'll be about 70, but I'll be sporting the 80s mesh muscle shirt. Just no muscles to go with it. But that's the opinion of a guy who's under the sun. There's nothing new. You look at 2 Corinthians 5:17, if any man be in Christ, he's a new creature. Old things are passed away. All things have become new. Lamentations 3:22 tells us, the Lord's mercies that are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. And most importantly, 2 Peter 3:13, nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness. There's new stuff coming. It's just coming from outside this system. If you believe this is a closed system and that's all there is and nothing will ever change, you're most miserable. But if you understand that there is a reality that's outside of our little perspective, it's like living in two dimensions, not realizing there's a third. You see the horizontal, but you never realize there's a vertical, that there's a spiritual side of things. He says, there's no remembrance of former things, neither shall be any remembrance of things that are come with those that shall come after. You know, the stuff that happens, it's all important, nobody's even going to remember it. Going backwards, how many vice presidents can you name? I had to search for Biden for a while. I was really struggling there. I didn't even get past him for a minute. And then before him was Cheney, also known as Satan. And then, right? And then before him, you had, who was before him? Gore, right? Gore was before him. Before Gore would have been Quayle. And before Quayle would have been George Bush, because he was vice president to Reagan. Who was Jimmy Carter's vice president? Fritz Mondale. Imagine that. Jimmy Carter. Before him was, Gerald Ford? Who did he have? He must be a history teacher. I mean, who knows this stuff? I don't know. How far back can you go, though, unless you're, you know, a Jeopardy fan? And you just forget that stuff. And that's like number two guy in the United States, and we don't even know, you know. I can think of Spiro Agnew just because didn't he resign in disgrace. That's about the only reason I can remember him. You forget this stuff. And he says, I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom according all things that are done under heaven. I decided to try education and learning. That's where the solution is going to be. If I just know enough stuff, if I just understand enough things. He says, this sore travail, this painful path, hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. With everything that I learned, I realized it was empty knowledge, and it was like trying to grasp the wind. That which is crooked cannot be made straight. That which is wanting cannot be numbered. There are things, no matter how much knowledge you have, that just can't be fixed in the world. If it could, we'd have a cure for the common cold. But we don't. There are some things, it doesn't matter how much you know, you can't figure out. So he said, I communed with my own heart, saying, lo. Now, this is always a mistake. He's doing a little, you know, group therapy with himself. Notice the eyes that he's going to spout and the mys here. I communed with my own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate. I've gotten more wisdom than all they which have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I gave my heart to know wisdom. And since that didn't satisfy, and to know madness and folly. Since I tried the wisdom and the knowledge route, and that wasn't pleasing, I might as well check out the foolishness route, just in case. You know, just in case that's where the happiness lies. He says, no, I perceived that this also is vexation of spirit. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increases in knowledge increases in sorrow. We know that's not true because we know that college campuses are full of the happiest people on the planet. That's where all the joyous, satisfied people are, on college campuses. Going to frat parties, drinking themselves blind to try to forget their misery. Yeah, that's not there. He says, I said in my heart, chapter 2, verse 1, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure. Behold, this is also vanity. I said of laughter, it's mad, and of mirth, what does it? Well, maybe if it's not wisdom and learning and it's not foolishness, maybe it's just in having a bunch of laughs, having a great time in comedy. Man, you go to a comedy club and people are having a ball. The comedian is hilarious. That's where true happiness is to be found. With guys like Belushi and Sam Kinison and Chris Farley. People who are so miserable trying to make other people laugh that they end up killing themselves on drugs. That's not where true pleasure is. Psalm 16, verse 11 says, thou wilt show me the path of life. In thy presence is fullness of joy. At thy right hand there are pleasures forevermore. But Solomon isn't looking there. He's looking as one who's underneath the sun, and so he doesn't get any of that. So where else can I go to find happiness and the meaning of life? I sought in my heart to give myself unto wine. Maybe it's getting loaded. Now you'd think he'd remember what his mom told him in Proverbs 31, the last chapter we read last week. It's not for kings, O Lemuel. It's not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes strong drink, lest they drink and forget the law, pervert judgment of any of the afflicted. Don't drink. That's a waste of time. Well, he said, I got to try it anyway. So I gave myself unto wine, although he didn't become a completely addicted, hopeless drunk. He said, yet acquainting my heart with wisdom. And this is a guy who could have any wine he wanted, okay? Because he could have, you know, he wasn't forced to drink, I don't know, Old Duke or whatever, cheap wine, Boone's Farm strawberry. No, this is a guy who, he didn't get his in a box, it didn't have a screw cap. This was the good stuff, you know, 3000 BC, Egypt's best, I guess, whatever. Oh, and to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. But that didn't satisfy. So he decided to try a real estate gig. He said, I made me great works. I builded me houses. That's what it is. See, I've been living in an apartment, and I'm unsatisfied. There's not enough room. I can't even paint the thing without talking to the landlord. I need a place of my own. So Solomon decided maybe it's in heaven house, but not just any old house, not a starter home, not a double wide, not a trailer, but I need me a real home. And you have to understand, Solomon, when he talks about building houses and stuff, he didn't do things on a scale that we did. Okay, let me read you a little passage from 1 Kings chapter 5, verse 13. King Solomon, he's a guy who used contractors, all right? He had a work crew. King Solomon raised a levy out of all of Israel, and the levy was 30,000 men. And he sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 a month, by courses. A month they were in Lebanon, and 2 months they were at home. And Adoniram was over the levy. So he had 30,000 guys just cutting wood, 10,000 a month. He'd send 10,000 to go cut wood, and then 10,000 more the next month, and 10,000 the next month. And Solomon had 70,000, that's 70,000 people that bear burdens. The people hauling the wood and hauling the material, the stones for the houses and things he built, he had another 70,000 guys working on that. And he had 80,000, that's 80,000 hewers in the mountains. So it took 80,000 people to cut the stones for his houses. It took 70,000 people to carry it and 30,000 people to cut the wood. This is not a spring addition. You know, it's not like the guys rebuilding the news over there that are just throwing that baby up. This is... And then he had a bunch of other people, too. He had officers over the work. And he built some great stuff. I builded me houses, and I planted me vineyards. You know, I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them, all kinds of fruits. Gardening is a sickness. You know, some people think that there's happiness to be found in gardening. I don't understand that. To me, that's like saying there's happiness to be found in, I don't know, jamming a needle in your eye. I mean, I just can't think of anything I hated weeding the garden. But there are some people, my stepdad has this sickness, you know, wanting to garden. But he knows true happiness is in the Lord, and I guess he just does that to pass the time until he sees him. But Solomon went all out. He's, you know, because if you're going to have houses, you might as well have some landscaping. I planted vineyards, I made gardens and orchards, I planted trees, all kinds of fruits. I made me pools of water to water therewith. You know, you got to have some springs and some ponds, and you got to have a fountain or two to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. But that's still not enough. Maybe it's because I've got too much to do. If I had some people to wait on me, then I'd be happy, right? Because I got to do everything myself. Just all I got is 80,000 guys here and 70,000. I need some servants, he said. So I got me servants and maids and servants born in my house. I had so many that they were, you know, having their own baby servants there. And I had great possessions. I had lots of stuff. Great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I had farming. I had livestock, cattle futures. I had the whole ball of wax. I had all of that stuff. And I gathered me also silver and gold, incredible wealth. And you know what happens when you get too much money that you don't know what to do with it? You get the next thing here, and the peculiar treasures of kings and of the provinces. Once I had so much money I didn't know what to do with it, I started collecting stuff. I became a partaker of antiquities. I started to buy, you know, the Fabergé eggs, and I started to buy the great paintings. He's collecting the treasures of kings. Well, now that I'm rich beyond imagination, I'm going to go collect all of the things that the other kings got that they thought would make them happy. And then music. I always liked music. Rather than go out and get the CD, he went out and got the band. He said, I got me men singers and women singers. I didn't listen to 38 Special. I own 38 Special. They did breakfast for me, and I've got, you know, whoever coming in to do lunch, a country band, and then maybe a good ballad around dinner time. But that didn't satisfy. He says, in the delights of the sons of men, as musical instruments, and that of all sorts. That's delights. That King James, if you're reading a different translation, yours probably says something different. What's translated as musical instruments there really doesn't mean musical instruments. They kind of did that out of context of the rest of the verse. What it really means is women. I had wine, I had song, I need some women. And if there was ever anybody who thought they could be pleased with women, Solomon made a run at it. 1 Kings 11:1, Solomon loved many strange women. Doesn't mean they were all, I mean, as many as he had, there had to be some strange ones, but it means they were foreigners. Together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, the Zidonians, the Hittites, of the nations concerning which the Lord said unto the children of Israel, you shall not go into them, neither shall they come in unto you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clave unto these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, 700 princesses, no, and 300 concubines, because, you know, you got to have some women on the side. I mean, just 700 wives. So we'll get 300 more that aren't really of the level where we will make them a wife, but we'll still keep them around. So he had 1,000 women. And yet, he still was not happy. He did everything that Deuteronomy 17 said a king shouldn't do. Don't multiply gold. Don't multiply horses. Don't multiply wives. He did everything he shouldn't have done. So I was great and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me, even in doing all of this. And the one thing about Solomon, and I, you know, I do have hope that Solomon came around in the end. I don't know. He said, my wisdom remained with me. There is a point where people can indulge themselves and they go whatever path it is that they go after, that their wisdom leaves them. They become completely consumed with their sin, and it's like a switch is snapped. You read the story of the prodigal son, and it isn't until he gets to the place where he's at the pig trough, eating the husks with the pigs, and then if you read the King James, it says, and then he came to himself. He came to himself. Which means he was not himself. He was out of his mind. He had gone so far down the path, and he took his inheritance early, went out, and he blew it all on riotous living and, you know, wine, women, and song. Not a good place to be. Solomon wisdom remained with him, maybe so that he could chronicle what he went through for us. And he shows us the surest recipe for misery. Whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was the portion of all my labor. Imagine a shopping spree when you have the Solomon card with no limits. Anything you want, you can have. You ever watch, you know, not watch the lifestyles of the rich and famous, but if you ever look at the lives of some of the today's celebrities and some of these guys, like Mike Tyson is a great example. You know, he gets to the place where he's making $50 million a fight and he's buying tigers. I mean, what would you possibly need a tiger for? Or a couple tigers, you know, I mean, like one isn't enough. I mean, Solomon's buying apes and peacocks and he's taking ivory thrones and overlaying them with gold. You can't even see the ivory. I mean, what's the point? At some point you have to say, isn't enough enough? But when you have no limits placed on you, you just continually try to consume. And that will make you miserable, no doubt. He says, then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit. There was no profit under the sun. He was in the hell of materialism. He had everything that we think we might want, and he realized that it wasn't enough. It wasn't satisfying. And I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do that comes after the king? Even that which has already been done. He says, nobody is going to be in a better position than me than to test out the limits of this thing. There's nobody who's going to come after me and say, oh, Solomon, you came close, but you didn't go quite far enough. If you had just bought a few more apes and a couple more peacocks, you'd have been happy, dude. No. He said, nobody. Who's going to come after the king and prove? They're just going to, at best, go through the ground that I've already covered. Then I saw that wisdom exceeds folly as far as light exceeds darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head. The fool walks in darkness. You know, I at least realize it's better to be wise than foolish because at least you can kind of see what's going on. And then he says, and I myself perceive that one event happens to them all. Wait a minute. He came to the realization, it doesn't matter whether I'm wise or a fool, rich or poor. We all still die. Well, then I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, so it happeneth even to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, well, this also is vanity. For there's no remembrance of the wise more than the fool forever, seeing that which now is in the days to come shall all be forgotten. And how dieth the wise man? As the fool. How many of you guys have grandparents that are alive? Anybody have grandparents that are alive? I don't. Great-grandparents? Great-great-grandparents? How many can name the names of your great-great-grandparents? Great-great. Two back. Great-great-greats? Great-great-great-greats? All wonderful people, I'm sure. I'm sure they lived amazing lives, and they probably sacrificed hard so that they're your great-great-grandparents and your great-grandparents and your grandparents and all of that, but yet we remember the ones that directly impacted our lives, but the ones that went before are at best a black and white tinny photograph in somebody's mantle. It gets forgotten. And someday all of the fun, cool things we did, if the Lord doesn't return, will just be grainy videos that somebody else looks at and says, I don't know, who are those people, Mama? Who are those people? What was that guy in the mesh shirt? What was he doing? Why that? Well, this is where he wound up. He says in verse 17, therefore, I hated life. Imagine that, the man who had everything, yet nothing. He hates life. Because the work that's wrought under the sun is grievous to me, for all's vanity and vexation of spirit. Yeah, I hated all my labor, which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it to the man that shall be after me. I can't take it with me. Somebody's getting all my apes and my peacocks and my gilded thrones and my houses and my gold and my silver and my Fabergé egg. Somebody gets all of that. And who knoweth whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? He might be a moron. In fact, he probably had a suspicion because he had 1,000 wives and one son, Rehoboam. And Rehoboam, in 1 week of being king, split the kingdom that David had established and Solomon had made. Split it so that 10 of them just said, "You're a moron, we're out of here." And he was left with Judah and Benjamin in the south. And then a little bit later on, Egypt is going to come in and invade them. And to save himself, he buys them off and he gives away most of the treasure that Solomon had accumulated. These great golden shields that Solomon had built, he gave them all of those and he had to put brass ones up in their place because he lost everything that Solomon had, like that. And I think Solomon might have seen it coming. You know, there are some people who have fools for children and they know from a fairly young age, man, this kid's a fool. I'm spending anything I got because he's just going to blow it. Make a trust for the grandchildren. Do something. This also is vanity. Therefore, I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. Everything I've done, everything I have, it's all going to come to nothing. For there's a man whose labor is in wisdom and in knowledge and in equity, yet to a man that has not labored therein shall he leave it for his portion. This also is vanity and great evil. Which is why Jesus says, lay up treasure in heaven, because that will last. For what has a man of all his labor and of the vexation of his heart when he's labored under the sun? For all his days are sorrows. His travail is grief. Yea, his heart takes no rest in the night. This also is vanity. Is this comforting to you that the richest and wisest man who ever lived, who had everything, couldn't even sleep at night? He couldn't even sleep at night because he looked at the future and he was thinking about the future without God in the picture. He never got any rest. And he finishes chapter 2 this way. He says, there is nothing better for man than he should eat and drink, and he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw, that it was from the hand of God. For who can eat, or who else can hasten thereunto more than I? For God gives to a man that's good in his sight wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner he gives travail, to gather and to heap up, that he may give it to him that's good before God. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. He says it just seems so arbitrary, you know, that really, if you just, you know, you got enough to eat, you got enough to drink, that should be enough. I mean, he's the guy who wrote Proverbs 15:16, better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble therewith. Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a stalled ox, you know, the fatted calf and hatred. That, you know, sometimes the best you can have is just a little to eat, a little to drink, and just be content. That's what Paul said. You know, godliness with contentment is great gain. Just if you've got enough food and something to wear, you should be happy with that. The thing about Solomon, and here we see him saying, God gives to man, that's good in his sight. He mentions God. He's going to say God in this book 36 times. I forget exactly how many. But it's interesting. He always says Elohim, which is, it's the creator God. He never says Jehovah, which is the Lord. He never says his name, which is Jehovah Yahweh. He never says that. He only says Elohim. And it's like he has what, he's a deist in this whole book. That's what he is. There's a God, but he's the God who started everything rolling, and he's not interested in the affairs of men. That it's just, you know, everything just happens. He started this ball rolling and it's just going to roll forever, generation after generation, time after time, and there's nothing new under the sun and everything's the same, and you're just going to live like a dog and die like a hog, and that's all there is. And that's misery. But thankfully, that's not the truth. Paul in Philippians chapter 3, we'll end here, verse 7, after listing out all of his accomplishments and everything he'd done in his life, he said, but what things were gained to me, those I counted loss for Christ. Yea, doubtless I count all things but loss for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ Jesus, my Lord, for whom I've suffered the loss of all things. And I do count them but dung that I might win Christ and be found in him. Not having my own righteousness, which is of the law, but that which is through the faith of Christ, the righteousness which is of God by faith. And this is the key, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, being made conformable unto his death. if by any means I might attain to the resurrection of the dead. Paul said, I found out there was more than what I thought was important in this life. And it wasn't things. It was one, that there is a God and that I can know him, that I can have a relationship with him, that he can know my name and he can be involved in my life. And two, that this is not all there is. Paul himself says, hey, if it's only in this life that Christ makes a difference, then, you know, we might as well eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. But Christ is risen from the dead, which means we're going to be risen from the dead, which means there's another life and there's another place, and that's what matters, not here. And this is just a staging ground for there. Solomon wasn't happy with all that he had and all that he did, and it's pretty safe to say that neither will we be, whether we have the wine, the women, the song, the instruments, the houses, the boats, the planes, the computers, the whatever it is that floats your boat, or you think floats your boat, it won't. Passing, fleeting, vanity, vexation of spirit, like trying to grasp the wind. Let's pray that the Lord would teach us that rather than make us experience it. Lord, thank you so much that you took the wisest man in the world and you moved him to record these things. Lord, I pray that you would remind us continually that it's only in you that there is pleasures forevermore. Lord, help us not to be caught up in the desire for the things, Lord, in the fleeting fancies of this world. Lord, help us to seek first your kingdom, your righteousness, and you can give us the stuff that you know that we need. Lord, I pray you would bless my brothers and sisters this week, that you would fill them with your spirit. You'd make them men and women like Abraham, who were just passing through, looking for a city whose builder and maker is God, a place with foundations. Lord, help us to hold on loosely. I ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Grace and peace, guys.